writing about drinking so I wouldn't drink. Mm. I was also writing about drinking because that's all I ever did. And then with Northline, it was, I was interested in anxiety. You know, with Allison Johnson, I was interested in the idea of weakness, of being so weak and hating yourself so much, and being so shy that you kind of just, you know, drinking's, you know, one of the ways that people like that survive, especially pre, you know, pharmaceuticals. And so I was interested in that aspect of it as well. When your crutch is, and for the Flanagan brothers, the crutch alcohol is a long-term, it's slowly cutting their feet off and their legs slowly, but slowly. But with her, it just kind of sucker punches her when she drinks. She's just not good at it. But I was interested in her still having to rely on it. It's a wicked friend. I think booze is always a wicked friend, but it's just like, it's just to some people it's a you know, grizzly bear, and then to other people it just starts out as a puppy pit bull, you know, and then you wake up one day and it's like got your, it's your neck an and it's not. Yeah.
Well, it's another interesting thing when you talk about, I think you were talking about this book, but you were talking about like, I spent this much time writing it, I think you had like a second half of it that you decided wasn't working or whatever, but you, one of the ways you were talking about your editing process or your reworking process is, so I stopped drinking, like that's the first sentence.
Oh, yeah.
I did yoga, I started running. So it made me think about, like, you know, what's that process like? Like, is it, do you have this kind of cleanse phase, whatever you want to say?
Yeah, I mean, look, I was kind of, you know, like Richard Fontaine, we were hellraisers, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of my drinking has always been, I mean, I love it. It you know, I'm good at it, I guess, if it can be. But it made it so I could go in front of people. It made it so I could go to the grocery store, you know, all that kind of stuff as a kid. But I always had, I could always pull back, you know. I always, you know, my brother said my greatest gift is, like, you know, if I go, I get drunk 2 days in a row, I get a cold. And so I can't, my body can't take it. So as I get older, you know, I battle with it, and I've kind of, you know, I've kept it in its place more or less. But, you know, when you're writing a novel, you know, I don't, you know, writing a novel, like, for me, it's like, I'm not that smart a guy, so I have to, like, use everything I can to, you know, to try to think my way through a bad, like, if I write myself into a bad situation. So usually what happens is I'll write a book, and I always take care of myself. I always say the same thing, which, and I apologize, but it's kind of true. Like, if you see me and you go, God, it looks like he's been sleeping under a car, then you know I'm probably writing songs, and I'm not working on a novel. And if you're like, I think he looks skinnier, and, you know, he shaved, and he looks like he lives somewhere, and then you go, oh man, he's, I wonder what kind of book he's writing. So with writing, I always kind of take care of myself, because you just have to. When I hit panic, you know, like I'm working on a book right now where it's just kind of like, you realize it's not that good, and it's not going well, then you have to start trying to change stuff. You know, and I go, my first thing is like, man, I was a house painter for years, and I probably lost a lot of my brain cells fumes. So I start getting mad at myself being a house painter. So a lot of self-hatred, I beat myself up for a while. And then you're like, all right, I'm gonna quit sugar, because they say sugar makes you dumb. And I'm already dumb, and I love donuts. So you're like, all right, I'll start there. And then you're like, only one beer. You can have one beer, maybe one shot of tequila, and that's it. And then you do that, and then you're like, you better start jogging again, and maybe you should, like, meditate. And then you do all that stuff in hopes that you get an ounce more, like, just one more brain cell to fire, and you'll figure your book out. So it's usually, that's what it is. And then,
does it work?
No, I mean, you can write better, you can write longer. Like, if you feel better, you can write longer, you can sit in a chair longer, you can,
yeah.
But I don't know, I mean, I think it does help. I mean, nothing, you know.
Yeah.
After a certain age, I mean, all a hangover does is you just watch more Rockford, and you eat more like fried chicken, and you know, you just, you don't answer any emails or phone calls, and you're mad at your dog because your dog won't lay next to you while you watch, you know, your eighth hour of Rockford. You're like, come on, man. And he's like,
oh, you love me?
Yeah, can we go out and do something? You're like, no, man, fried chicken's coming up and, you know, Jimbo's, you know, an angel. Can't we just lay in bed sport? So, you know, and then, you know,
yeah.
Hangovers come the next day, comes, you know, the guy punching you, and the guy's punching you is yourself. And you know, that's a pain in the ass too, so.
All right, I think it's a good segue. Should we go to the night always comes? Would you read us a bit, sir?
Yeah, I mean, this is just a scene where Lynette gets her first, who's the main protagonist, gets her first boyfriend. Here's a woman who doesn't know how to love. I don't think she's ever really been loved properly. Mm-hmm. She's been with men, but she's never had a boyfriend, and a good boyfriend, like someone that treats her decently. And I was interested in the idea of what happens when you get a really traumatized person starts going out with an untraumatized person that's had a good family and a good upbringing, it's a good person. So here's just a little bit of that. Within 4 months, she spent 3 nights a week in his apartment and started taking birth control. They had sex nearly every time they saw each other. And for the first time in her life, she had orgasms. When she stayed at his place, he would wake her up with a cup of coffee. He would walk her to work at 6 and pick her up after she got off. He spent all his money on her. And after 5 months, he told her he loved her. He told her he wanted to marry her someday. Jack had a pickup truck. And each week when he got paid, he took her out to eat in a different part of town. They saw movies together. They got drunk together. And they saw bands play. They went roller skating at Oaks Park and ice skating at Lloyd Center. They walked in and out of high-end downtown stores. They spent weekend afternoons strolling through neighborhoods looking at houses they wanted to live in. They went to furniture stores and picked out furniture that would go in those houses. After 8 months, he drove her to Seaside for the day to meet his parents, and then Eugene, where his brother Henry was taking classes at the community college to be a mechanic. There was a gentleness to Jack that she could disappear into. Never once did he blindside her or intentionally try to hurt her. He would get nervous or grumpy, insecure or angry. But when he did, he would try to talk to her about it. He would try to explain himself to her, explain the way he felt. She introduced him to her mother and Kenny. And to Lynette's great relief, Jack liked Kenny. He wanted to spend time with her brother. So they began taking Kenny to lunch at the Sexton on Columbia River so he could watch the boats pass. They took him to the airport to see the planes take off, the stock car races, the baseball games, to the hot cake house, and to the horse track. Jack took them camping near Mount Hood. Neither she or Kenny had ever been camping before. They had never sat by a campfire. Jack was the first man that Kenny ever really liked. He was the first man Kenny ever ran to and hugged when he saw him. There were times when Lynette was certain that Jack had been sent by her grandfather to save her life. When they would go to the hot cake house, she would secretly pray to herself and thank her grandfather for remembering her and caring enough about her to bring Jack to her. Thank you, thank you, thank you, she'd say. But after a year, it started. The old Lynette would reappear. In those moments, her sadness and hopelessness and anger would rush past her like a speeding car. It nearly broke her when it first happened, because she realized she hadn't rid herself of who she'd been. She hadn't rid herself of herself. And once she knew that, it became a fog that chased her, a fog that would never completely disappear. At first, she was able to keep it under control because it only came up when she was tired, sick, or too drunk. Over time, though, it took more and more work. She began to having to force herself to act happy. She told Jack none of this because she was certain if he knew how much she struggled and what she was really like, he would leave her.
Oh, breaks my heart every time I hear it.
Yeah, man, that breaks my heart too.
Yeah. doesn't it? Just
yeah, you know, and I feel so bad for her because she has to act instead of. To cope with it, and you know, I think with Lynette, it's always been rage is her equal, it's how she hits reset buttons and how she gets control of her life is to rage, and she knows she's gonna pop on and rage this really cool guy, and she can't stop it, and he has no idea what's going on. He's caught in the storm of a person that's has a lot of hard miles underneath her that she's never let anybody see. It's a hard thing to do, especially if you've never been in a safe situation, to be able to do that. And she, you know, she grew up on movies and romance, and she doesn't want to admit, like, hey, I'm not this perfect girlfriend that's going to be with this perfect guy. I got a lot of baggage and I'm beat up. I don't think she was ready to admit that. And so, you know, when you're young, you think you can hide all that stuff and become some other person. And I don't think, I don't think she was really at that age could articulate the amount of pain that she was in or carrying with her.
That's the heartbreaking thing, is she was happy with him, and then finding out she couldn't outrun it.
Yeah, it's hard when you can't outrun yourself. I mean, it's rough, man. I mean, everybody has to come to that on their own, in their own way. Some people keep outrunning it their whole lives, and I know guys that have never dealt with anything their whole life, and they compartmentalize, and it starts eating at them, and they know it's eating at them, but they just can't do it. Yeah. Maybe they can get through life without ever really dealing with stuff, but it takes, you know, there's a cost to be paid.
How did you decide to have it be a woman instead of a man? Who's the person?
Well, I was interested in a family that stuck together longer than they should. And I was interested, a couple reasons. So it's a mother and an adult daughter who's 30, and then a developmentally disabled older brother who's 32, who's Kenny. I was interested in those three sticking together longer than they should, and they're sticking together because of Kenny. I thought if Lynette was a man, he would have left the family. He probably would have sent money, but he would have abandoned them. Maybe that's just my own take on men, but I think Lynette feels such guilt of how she's been to her mom and to her brother, maybe even, that she's decided to stay. And so I wanted this family dynamic where you have a person who still believes in trying the American dream of home ownership, of that you can work your way out of a bad economic situation. You can work so hard that you'll rise above. And then the mom saying, no, you can't. And so you meet the mom at that, she's already kind of cracked and it's falling apart. And she becomes the idea of, like, you know, just scrape by, you know, lie big, borrow steal kind of idea. But there's no use fighting it, and Lynette still wants to fight. So to me, having a woman would be the only way to make that story work. And also, I was interested in the idea of rage is a defense mechanism, and I thought that'd be much more interesting. And I was more interested in that, the power of that when a woman uses rage, is, you know, in a weird sort of way, it's scarier, more scary than when a man uses rage. When a man uses rage, sometimes you're just like, man, he's a man, like just a bomb, you know, but when a woman uses rage, it seems more heavy to me and more complicated, you know? Yeah. And so I guess that's why I set it up the way I set it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was interested in that idea of, like, with Lynette, she's really working, like, she's real blue collar. She's not that educated. she's really narrow in how she can perceive of getting money. So I was really interested in that idea of what do you do when all of a sudden the housing prices increase so much, like everything increases so much that you can't think, you can't work 24/7 working as a baker or a bartender and figure out how to make enough money just to own a house in the city. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested in a person also who's real stubborn, and she can't really see another way, like the way she's going is not going to work, and she can't see outside that because I don't think she knows better. So she just works and works and then ends up doing what people do when they need money and you do something illegal.
But I also think that's what makes it like the like heart pounding pace of the book is her desperation.
Well, I was really interested in the idea of self-sabotage. I think, you know, the when they have the opportunity to buy the house, the mom, she realized she's like, hey, you know, we're paying all this money for a house near a freeway that's pretty much a teardown. She doesn't buy into it. But part of that is she doesn't want to sacrifice anymore for the family. She doesn't want to sacrifice for her son anymore. She doesn't like her daughter. She doesn't want to live the rest of her life with her daughter. She doesn't want to give towards them to help them have a better life in the future. She's like, why not me? So part of the argument in the book is like me versus Lynette is saying, no, we have to care about community. We have to care about the family. And I think the mom's so beaten down too and has tried hard and failed in her own ways and really worked hard in her own ways. She's just like, I just want something shiny and nice. So when I drive down the street, I look cool and I feel like I'm important, that I've been successful at something. I've always been interested in that idea. And you know, with the rapid gentrification of Portland and the dramatic, like jaw-dropping shift in this city in a short period of time, made that story, you know, kind of jump out at me.
The way that you, in the book, have these exploiting men, right, where they each exploit Lynette, you give them a chance to sort of defend themselves in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those the big battles of humanity that just, I guess as you get older, you get more cynical about it, which is that idea of powerful people taking advantage of weaker people with no power, and it happens time and time again, and there's such a pull in humanity to destroy any kind of any way of equalizing. Yeah. And so I think with Lynette, you see like probably the nicest man in it of those men is the old money Portland. So she first meets the old money guy who was just a businessman, but there's no love there, no kindness there. And then there's the new money guy she meets who, I mean, he's so rich, like an IT money rich guy, that he has somebody else. And I've painted houses like this, for guys like this, where they hire stylists to pick out their clothes. They hire stylists to decorate their house. They hire somebody to cook their meals for them. And they have no personality underneath it all. Like they didn't pick the bad couch, you know, and they didn't pick the bad, you know, photograph that no one else likes, but they like. And that guy has no idea of humanity, of the pain he's putting this woman through. It's all about power to him and like what he can get away with. And then it goes down to like the criminal guy who just like the guys that see, you know, they're all fine and good. And then they see the $100 on the ground and then they're like, oh man, that's me. It's like Treasure Sierra Madre kind of stuff where temptation corrupts a lot of people. And then you get the guy, the self-righteous guy, the repo guy, who says one thing and talks about how greed's bad and like you should only buy what you can pay for. And he takes advantage of her because he thinks he can. And he's got an angle like so many people do. You think and think and think until you find an angle that backs up your idea. And you're like, well, you know, I got this reason and this belief now that I deserve to take your money. And so I think he just had to find it in his mind. So yeah, it's a night of like her going into like kind of the darker side of greed, which, you know, obviously is so interesting in Portland, like these, you know, kind of beat up neighborhoods, and then somebody buys a house, tears it down, builds a mansion near it, and then, you know, at the same time, there's just cities of homeless people. It's a really interesting shift and frightening. And so sitting in St. John's, I'd look out the window and walk around, and you just can't help it. It just sinks into you. So I needed to write the story to try to figure out my ideas on it. Mm-hmm.
Did you like know that you wanted to write that going in, or did it sort of come out the way that it came out and then you saw the
I wanted pretty much all the things we talked about I was interested in before I started. I made a couple bad, you know, I always do. I, you know, with this book, I wrote a whole other novel, really, where she and Kenny leave together, and it was, you know, it didn't work, and it took, you know, a year and a half of my life. And that was one of my, pull out the yoga DVDs, and like, my brother's always trying to get me to meditate, and I'm like, you know, I better do all this, you know, listen to my self-help tapes, so I can get together. But in the end, it's just, you know, I just had to cut that whole section out. I generally know what I want to do before I start, but I always make like, you know, a wrong turn in Albuquerque, and then I spent years trying to fix it. I wrote a book called Lean on Pete. That was one where I just kind of sat down and wrote it. It was a pretty simple story, and that one I didn't have to mess with too much. The rest of them were really hard. I wrote like an extra 300 pages to Don't Skip Out on Me. I wrote a whole other novel. It was supposed to be in that novel. It just didn't work. So I've made some blunders along the way. Yeah, sure. But, you know, you just kind of stick with it and trust your gut. Mm-hmm. Just trust your gut until you're ready to let it go.
Is it true, you've talked before about you write a song, and something about the song becomes the sort of North Star that turns into your novels?
Yeah, I mean, all my novels except for this one.
That's what I was going to ask. Is there a song?
No, I mean, my band did a soundtrack, the DeLions did a soundtrack to it, with the paperback version, which comes out in May, has the soundtrack in it, or a link to it. But I wrote that afterwards. In general, all my books started as songs. It'd be an idea, like Lean on Pete started as a song. Mm-hmm. First with a song called Laramie, Wyoming by Richard Fontaine. And then I wrote a song called Lean on Pete because I used to bet on a horse named Lean on Pete at Portland Meadows and always won them. And the times I didn't bet on it, it would win. I mean, it was just like the one horse I always did get on. And so I wrote a song called Lean on Pete, which basically is the whole story. And, you know, it was a miserable, like, 7-minute folk song that never went anywhere.
Yeah.
Northline started as songs. Motel Life started a bunch of songs. The Free started as songs. Don't Skip Out on Me started as song. So yeah, a lot of them are linked, but with Lynette, it was so panicked. Lynette's not melancholy. She's got an edge on her. And I didn't think she had time for music. And I couldn't see my way in. And then the DeLions were working on our record, The Sea Drift. And I asked the trumpet player and keyboardist, Corey Gray, really great guy and a really amazing writer too, if he would come up with some trumpet instrumentals. And he came in with this song, and it was so beautiful. And while he was
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.
Ja!
For say life is an illusion. Tell me what you're thinking, Jal Provider.